2006. My name is Daryl Bradford Smith. It's great to have you here with me on this most special of interviews today. We have a longtime collaborator and friend of mine from military background, Lieutenant Colonel Karen Kotowski. Of course, you know Karen has been fighting very hard to get the truth out about a lot of subjects and spends a lot of time actually helping young people to learn about the world in her professional life. So I have nothing but the highest admiration for this woman, and I respect her opinion very much. So it's really a pleasure to have her on with me today. Karen, are you with me?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Well, I hope you can accept that those platitudes, because you really are somebody that I look up to in some of these some of this information we've gone through. Because you know, it took some courage to leave that Pentagon environment and actually start talking about some of the oddities that were evident when you left. I mean, could you give the people a little rundown so that, because there's a lot of people who've come to this since the last time we spoke. I mean, my listenership is over double, and many of them may not know just some of the anomalies that you experienced in the Pentagon.
Sure. Well, I was in the Air Force and had been assigned to the Pentagon in 1998 and eventually moved over into the Office of Secretary of Defense around 2000, worked Sub-Saharan African Affairs policy at the very end of the Clinton administration and then at the beginning of the Bush administration.
Mm-hmm.
Then that, of course, the new set of political appointees, Doug Feist became the new Undersecretary for Policy. And I was still in Sub-Saharan Africa, but in May of 2002, I was moved over into the Near East South Asia division, and this is basically the Middle East division under a guy named Bill Lutie. Also under Doug Feist, I was it was basically an interdepartmental move. And at that time, in May of 2002, I was very surprised to find out that the war plans to invade Iraq were already in their second, maybe even third, revision. A lot of detailed work had been done.
And how long does it take to get a first draft for those kinds of plans? I mean, in a general sense. I know you can't give specifics, but...
Well, sure. We have, the military has all kinds of strategic plans and concept plans on the shelf all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But those are skeletons in their drafts, and they're basically just the starting point. You take that starting point and turn it into an operational plan. Normally, obviously if you're attacked on your own land, you're going to respond very quickly. But if you're prosecuting a war, which of course this is a war not only that we were prosecuting, but a war of choice, certainly
yeah.
A war where we called the shot, you're looking at 4 to 6, maybe even 8 months, possibly more. So apparently, I was very surprised to see the maturity of this very detailed operational plan to invade Iraq at that time, particularly as we hadn't really, it had not really been widely discussed or promoted. Certainly, the last word that most people had was in 2001, both before 9/11 and after 9/11, where Iraq was seen as a country that was well contained. It was in the box. It may have aspirations, but had no capability. In fact, had been badly suffering from over a dozen years of sanctions and bombing through the no-fly zone enforcement, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So certainly why we would be invading, I was very shocked, and even working in policy, was very surprised. This was not something I don't think that was widely known, by people in the Pentagon, just those working on it. So that was one sign, and there were others, certainly, through the summer, political appointees from outside the Pentagon, in fact, almost to a person, with limited or no military experience, from very pro-Israeli think tanks, a lot of them, things like the Washington Institute for Near East Affairs, some people, American Enterprise Institute, which is not particularly pro-Israeli, but certainly a neoconservative outfit, had some folks over. And these folks are spending a lot of time in our office. Some of them are kind of hot bunking with our desks, and it's very crowded throughout the summer of 2002. And by the end of the summer, the Office of Special Plans was set up, and those folks that had been kind of sharing space with us in the Middle East Division moved into space that they had, I think, one floor up.
Now, is the Office of Special Plans, is that something that commonly is set up for projects that are in the works? Or,
no.
In other words, or is that was that the name given to this specific group of plans?
The office was described to us in a staff meeting that Bill Luddy had for all of us there, and he had a staff meeting late August and said, I'm happy to tell you that the folks, our crowding situation will soon be solved. We have space. These guys are going to be the Office of Special Plans. But then he said, don't really go around talking, referring to them as the Office of Special Plans. He says, what they are is the expanded Iraq desk. And just to jump to the present a little bit, this idea of expanding a particular desk is not necessarily unusual. Calling it Special Plans is. But this is exactly what they're doing with the Iran desk now.
That was going to be my next question, because it looks like the same kind of spin, and I'm certain the same kind of pre-position planning has already been done, yes?
It seems to be happening exactly as it did before, and the bad thing is, the way it happened before was, I think, through subterfuge. I mean, many of the people in Congress in the summer of 2002, spring of 2002, and even in the fall of 2002 were I think, surprised and taken aback by all of this stuff that we have to do Iraq, it's very dangerous. I mean, the president and the vice president were giving speeches about Iraq is going to put weapons of mass destruction on unmanned aerial vehicles.
Well, didn't they have a 45-minute window of attack from Iraq to hit us or something? It was ridiculous.
It was totally ridiculous, and it was crazy things. And the weird thing for the poor congressmen, and I don't actually have sympathy for the congressmen, they should have known better, but these guys never even had, at the time, in August, early September, they didn't even have a CIA National Intelligence estimate on Iraq or WMD in Iraq. Nothing like that. So here they are, basically the Congress is not being informed that there's any problem, but the Pentagon and the White House are processing a war plan, an operational war plan, and they're doing this all without congressional opinion, and they're kind of shaping congressional action, as we all saw in the summer and fall and winter of 2002, early 2003. This whole thing was a steamrolled operation, and it is very alarming when we see the similar process of an expanded desk. In fact, the weird thing, and I don't know 100% if this is true, but I have heard, and I've read this in, I think, mainstream newspapers like the Post and the Times, that the person in charge, or one of them, who's a key player in this expanded Iran desk, okay, assuming we're doing the same thing all over again for Iran, is Abe Shulsky, same guy that was running the Office of Special Plans. So,
okay.
Yeah, it's kind of concerning. Dr. Shulsky is a has no military experience, but he has written a couple of books on intelligence, and he's publicly one of the people that he's what they call a Straussian. I don't know if he's...
Is he a dual citizen Israeli, do you know?
I don't know that. I do not know that. That would be interesting. It wouldn't be...
I'll bet dollars to donuts you'd find out that he is.
Well, that kind of a thing needs to be publicized, or at least determined, if it's true. I would think that most of those folks who, like Dr. Shulsky, like Richard Perle and Doug Feist, people who we would suspect of being, you know, dual Israeli in part because of just their politics, I would suspect that they're very careful not to be dual citizens because of the security clearances that they're required to have. So,
well, wasn't Scooter Libby dual? I thought he was. Erwin Lieberwitz, I should say.
I don't know, but when you have clearances, I think the dual citizenship thing is probably an issue. But you never know, because every person that you've mentioned and all the people we're talking about here at this point are political appointees, and rules are modified a bit for political appointees. They're held to the same thing as maybe a civil servant. military person, that kind of thing. So
okay.
I can't say for sure, but, and I don't, certainly, I do not have any, you know, I don't know if Abe Schulsky is. I mean, you asked the question, I don't have the answer to that, but.
Well, I want to just shift, and we'll go back to that in one second, but Kathleen Christensen just wrote an incredible piece for Counterpunch and for Information Clearinghouse.
Mm-hmm.
And it floored me because this is the first time I've seen anybody of her caliber actually come out and rip bare some of the lies that people have been living under for so long, Karen. And a lot of it went back to her knowledge of the Pentagon, too. And she talked a lot about the Zionist influence within our Pentagon is absolutely appalling. And this is a 27-year CIA analyst. And, I mean, she said that if you were to take a look at this as a rational human being, you can come to no other conclusion but we are bought and paid for within our military structure.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of evidence to that, and it goes way back. I mean, we can talk about the USS Liberty, and I know sure your guests are familiar with that. That thing, and that, of course, is before our time as adults anyway, as far as professionals, and still you see this degree of influence, and it's very alarming. The thing that I saw, and I wrote about this in the American Conservative and in Salon when I first retired. Oh, I didn't get to the reason I got out.
Okay, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you. I just thought that was important, huh?
Sure. No, I got out because I became very upset starting really with my surprise at how mature the war plan was, and seeing how decisions were being made, seeing who was making those decisions, political appointees with doing it in isolation from the professional military, the professional intel, basically doing whatever they wanted to do with of course America's military, and that very much upset me, and I moved my retirement date up several times and finally retired. And when I retired, I wrote an op-ed and it was run in at the time the Knight Ridder newspapers, now McClatchy papers, and wrote for Lou Rockwell publicly, and became somewhat of a pariah among the neoconservatives because what I was saying, of course, was not something that they wanted to hear, and it was not something they wanted publicized, and that was basically the hijack of our policy, at least regarding the invasion of Iraq. But in any case, I wrote a story for the American Conservative in the winter of 2003, and for Salon in the spring of 2004, and in that I related a story that I was an eyewitness to, a party to, in a sense. And it was nothing very complicated, but we had a bunch of Israeli visitors. So some were Israeli generals, and some were there was a representative from the embassy, and some others. About six of them, and we had to escort them. Me and another guy were called, basically to substitute for their primary escort, who couldn't do it. So this was something very unusual, just happenstance. Went down to get these guys, and as soon as they realized we were their escorts and saw that they were free to enter the building, we were taken up to Doug Feist's office, but they led the way. In fact, we almost had to jog to keep up with them. They were moving so fast, and when they got into Doug Feist's office, apparently they had been there many times before, because as you know, the Pentagon, kind of a bunch of rabbit trails. So you kind of find out if you know if someone's familiar with it or not. And these guys were very familiar with the Pentagon. They were very familiar with the how to get to Doug Feist's office. And then when they got there, Doug Feist had a guest, and his door was shut. Well, one of them just never stopped, never slowed down, just went straight up to the door and pushed it open and pretty much tried to go in. The secretary jumped up and stopped him, said Doug Feist has a guest, and so you can't, you need to wait. And in that time where these Israeli visitors were waiting, they were kind of impatient, and I noticed the open sign-in log. This is Doug Feist's facility is a secure compartmented information facility, a SCIF, and there are different security procedures for these types of facilities.
Mm-hmm.
We've just been through, all of policy had just undergone in the previous couple of months security inspection, and we'd all been reminded of the rules, because not everyone, we don't all follow those rules, but we had been reminded of them recently, which was why the book was out. And so I saw the book out, the sign-in log, and I gestured to the secretaries and said, would you like these guys to sign in while they're waiting? Because obviously they had to do something with that dead time. And she threw up both her hands and said, oh, no, they don't have to sign in. So at that point, me and the guy I was with, the other Navy lieutenant commander, I believe, Navy lieutenant, he and I left, and we talked about it on the way back. We thought it was kind of strange that they knew where they were going, that they were very comfortable with barging in basically on Doug Feist's office and any guests that he had, and that they were not expected to sign in as others were, and it was kind of strange.
Well, when did you finally realize that these people also had connections to Irwin Leibowitz?
Well, I'm not. When you say Leibowitz,
Scooter Libby. His name's Irwin Leibowitz.
Scooter Libby. No.
No, his name is actually Irwin Leibowitz. I didn't know if you knew that.
Right. Well, I have heard that, but you're right. It didn't ring a bell with me. I have heard that. Yes, it has his name. But Scooter Libby, with these particular Israeli guests, I would not make the connection. The connection I would make with Scooter Libby, in my own personal experience, was with Abe Schulsky and Doug and Bill Libby.
And this is kind of top down pressure coming to kind of get this stuff whipped up and ready to go here.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, it's you know, to some extent. It's very clear, and we know this. You know, we certainly give lots of money, military money, to the Israelis. You know, and they have to. They're supposed to take that tax-funded money, much as other countries do, who receive money from us. They use it to buy American stuff, but they also use it to do joint military technology things. So we have, you know, it's understandable in a way that you'd say, well, you know, we work with the Israeli military. Certainly, we do. But the relationship should, you know, we have to be clear on who's in charge of the relationship, I think, is the thing. And so the appearance was, certainly, and I know people that, many people who read my observations, what I had seen in the Pentagon, the conclusion many people made, and I think it's fair, is that we aren't in charge of that relationship.
We're not, and it's maybe it seems to me too, after reading recent news events too, you know, that the American taxpayer needs to be reminded they just peppered the entire southern Lebanon region with American taxpayer cluster bombs that are going to go on and kill civilians for probably months, even years from this date forward.
Yeah, it's very true. In fact, I don't think Americans really understand that at all. Now, Lebanon, certainly, this whole deal with going after Hezbollah and the invasion and destruction of pretty much the whole country, although I think it's mostly the east and south of the country that was kind of physically destroyed with American munitions that we provided them to the Israelis. This operation, you know, occurred obviously and was, if there was any planning involved in the Pentagon, with it, of course, I was not in the Pentagon at that time, but this is one of those things where you can actually look at it two ways. Had it turned out positively for Israel, which it did not, this was a huge failure.
Well, I mean, the Lebanese lost 1,000 civilians and maybe 25 Hezbollah, and the Israelis lost 100, but they also destroyed about $5 billion worth of homes and streets and water systems.
Right. And this is why I say they lost, because Hezbollah is not weaker, it's actually stronger, and Israel's standing in the world community is a couple steps down the rung from what it was before.
Well, it's not far enough down from my taste.
Well, it's never very high. You know, Israel has just the way they run their country. You know, they in fact, you know what, I have to say this. The way Israelis seem to run their country in some respects is something the Americans could take a lesson from. They put Israel first every time, all the time. Now, how Israel's interests are determined, sometimes it's Likud, sometimes it's labor, you know, it's not clear what interests are being, you know, are being accepted as national interests. But in any case, they put Israel number one. They'd never put Israel number two, and I think that is a good advice. That's what we should do in this country, and I think one of the things that, you know, we certainly lost huge credibility with the thing they did in Lebanon, because number one, it was our munitions, and number two, apparently they consulted with American policymakers, and we said we will not only not do anything, we will fly cover for you at the UN, and we will continue to supply you as you do this thing, which makes us combatants in this thing.
So that's right.
Whose idea was that? Now, if that was George Bush's idea, then George Bush is an idiot.
We know that already, but I mean, if he really was part of that, they killed 1,000 civilians, then he's guilty of war crimes. He's guilty of,
certainly. Now, it could be either way, it's bad. If it was George Bush's idea and he said, oh, this is a great idea, let's have the Israelis do this, that's one thing. Very, very wrong, very criminal, okay, illegal in every way. Not that he wouldn't do it. I think Iraq fits the same bill. But if it was Israel's idea and they kind of brought America on board, then we have a real national interest and national security problem. And, of course, you know, another thing that fits in with this is the whole Larry Franklin case. Now, I work with Larry.
Yes. I wanted to ask you about that. One question before you get into Larry.
Mm-hmm.
I want to know if Larry, in your view, was visited by any of these top managers and while he was at that desk next to yours. I mean, did you see him, shaking hands with Mr. Leibowitz or Mr. Feith or any of these others?
No, I never saw any of that stuff. And Larry's desk was down the hallway a little bit from mine. And I knew Larry really only socially, not in terms of, I saw him in the office. We shared space. I passed by his desk when I went to my desk, said hi to him. I really was surprised that Larry was, when he was arrested, I was kind of surprised that he was in as deep because he did not actually, to me, appear to be, he appeared to me, and I've written about this before, but just my opinion and my observation, it seemed like he was a much smaller player. He's not the one that no Israeli general or senior policy maker from Israel or from the United States seemed to me would really be visiting Larry. If anything, Larry might be reporting to their office to bring them something. I saw Larry as much of, in fact, he was basically the Iran desk, much as the India desk, the Pakistan desk, a desk officer. That was his role. Now, when I read that Larry had gone with Michael Ledeen, American Enterprise Institute guy, big neoconservative, a big advocate for the invasion and occupation of Iraq, certainly an advocate for destabilizing Iran. He's been talking about that for 20 years. He has Iran connections. There's Garbanifar and those kinds of folks are friends of Ledeen's. And when Larry was associated with Ledeen in meetings and in conversation, that was kind of interesting. But you got to realize, too, Ledeen is outside the Pentagon. He is a friend of these policymakers. He's certainly a neoconservative ideologue, and he's well-connected. In fact, one of Ledeen's friends is pretty well-known to be Karl Rove.
Okay, well, he's a policy point man, isn't he? Similar to several others, like we've got William Kristol out there as a point man for much of this stuff that gets sent around. And Richard Perle, of course, is another point man out there.
Yeah, sure. And what you see, though, is you see and this is why people refer to American foreign policy in the Middle East as having been hijacked. You have your regular folks, your professionals, your military, and your mainstream political appointees who are simply trying to do their job. And quite frankly, I think Rumsfeld falls to some extent in that. Rumsfeld has a lot of things on his plate, and some of those things have nothing to do with the Middle East and have nothing to do with Israeli interests. It's true, at the Rumsfeld level. But then you have folks outside of normal standard policy channels who, quite frankly, are making, influencing, crafting, shaping, and implementing policies. And these are the guys like Ledeen in and out of the Pentagon, like Richard Perle, who had been for a couple of years there the chairman of the Defense Policy Board.
Yep.
These guys that are, and Doug Feist, as a policy undersecretary, he doesn't really make policy. He really implements it. You know, a lot of these guys, you never know what their names. You quite frankly never know. If I asked you at any point under the Clinton or the Herbert Walker Bush administration, who is the Defense Undersecretary of Policy, you could not tell me.
Right.
We know it's Doug Feist because he's gone, I think, in some ways beyond the norm of that position in terms of really getting into detailed policy, at least in Doug Feist's case, in with regard to Israel, Turkey, the Middle East, and Iraq, and that kind of thing. Doug Feist really works hard on that. It'd be nice if Doug Feist, as Undersecretary of Policy, would look at Asian policy issues, look at relations with the former Soviet Union, Russia, Ukraine, and this kind of thing. It'd be nice if Doug Feist would put that kind of attention on the rest of the world, and he does not, which is one of the reasons we know his name.
That's right.
Doug Feist is no longer there. You know, the current, do you know the current Undersecretary for Policy?
Well, no, and I wouldn't know for the very reason you just explained.
In part, that's true. Actually, you should know this guy's name. It's Eric Eidelman. And
oh, yes, I do know that name. I absolutely do.
Because he was the appointed ambassador to Turkey.
That's right.
And, sure. So it fits in with this overweening obsession we have with the Middle East, which really doesn't match American national
interest. Well, Karen, you know, let me ask you something, because here's a little sidebar on that, because you know Turkey has mm-hmm. been under the sway of Israel and powerful interests of Israel for 100 years, including all the way back to where the Young Turks were actually implementing a new government under the Ataturk. And so this is not if you know your history and you actually get to read real history books, you'll know that this relationship goes back a century or more. So there's no surprise here that somebody like Edelman or others would be working closely with Turkey, and there's no surprise that the Americans have had this special relationship with both Israel and Turkey for a long time.
Yeah, and also, again, I want to emphasize that one thing I admire about and I admire actually very little about some of the policies that Israel. I mean, this attack that they did supposedly against Hezbollah, the destruction, the isolation, the embargo associated with Lebanon, this total contempt for the life of Christians, the life of Muslims, the life of Arabs. This is very upsetting. So I'm very concerned about that. Not to even mention the way that the Palestinians are treated. Okay, these are bad problems. But there isn't. I admire the way that Israel looks after Israel. Israel is number one in Israel's foreign policy book. And their relation with Turkey is very strategic. It's very long-term. It's not just military in the sense that they can help Turkey out with military issues and intelligence and things like that. I mean, Turkey owns headwaters that are very necessary to the survival of Israel. And also, there's a pipeline, in fact, that was just... interestingly enough, your buddy, Michelle Chesedowski, wrote a wonderful article on
mm-hmm.
the ribbon cutting for a gas and, it's a multiple pipeline, but it's gas and, natural gas and oil coming from, the Caspian region, comes across Turkey and goes out on one of the Turkish ports just north of Lebanon. And, this is a joint venture with the Turks, with the Americans, the British, and the Israelis. And I think there may be a few other investors, but the main investors are those four. And
well, if you knew the other pipeline that they've got planned is going to come down from the central Kurdish region,
exactly.
Right across Iraq and through and out to Haifa Harbor.
Well, exactly. And, you know, Doug Price was a big player in that. Right after we invaded in 2003, we invaded Iraq, and I think Mission Accomplished had already been, we'd done the Mission Accomplished thing. George Bush had done his little... first of the 100 Mission Accomplished speeches.
The dancing chimp is what I call him.
Dancing chimp, sure. Well, he's doing his thing, and shortly after that, Feith gets in the news. Doug Feith is in the news for aggressively pushing this Haifa pipeline across Iraq, and it does stop in its tracks. But certainly, it will. I'm sure that will be a productive thing. But again, Israel's pursuit of its own positioning economically, its security positioning, there's nothing wrong with Israel looking after itself. What's wrong is to the extent that United States national interests are subsumed or, altered in some way because of Israel's interests. And if this is happening, and I don't know because I'm not in these meetings, but it certainly seems in some ways it's happening.
Well, let me say this. They have pre-positioned political operatives within our political system, but they've done that also in Britain. They've also done it in France. They've also done it in Germany. And what you'll see is that there's almost a muted resistance to anything these people demand from any of these countries.
Yep.
And so the simple truth of the matter is that our politicians in all the Western countries are actually working for the Israelis. And this has become quite clear to many of us who've looked at it. I mean, and it's painful to see this because these people have some very dastardly plans on the drawing board.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, it's very clear, you know, the reaction to the Mearsheimer-Walt paper. They wrote a paper, very mild. It had many, many footnotes. It's actually a pretty mild paper. But what it says is that it says that the Israeli lobby, and specifically they're talking about AIPAC, the AIPAC lobby in Washington, but they talk about how it works and its effectiveness in the way that it does business. And there's some documented, well-documented examples of lots of different ways. And some of it, you mentioned political operatives. I'm not sure if the Meerschaum or Walt Paper talks about that, but they certainly talk about what happens to the campaign coffers, where AIPAC, a very well-funded lobby, puts their money. And it's not about politics. It's not about they'll support Republicans, they'll support Democrats. Lieberman is just as good as, some other person that you might associate with the Republican Party. They're all good because they're reliable on Israel. And this is something, and you can't blame a lobby for doing that if they can do it. The fact is, though, what you have to blame is a country that allows that to happen. And I can't speak for Britain or any other country, but certainly in this country, we have some accounting to do because these guys don't vote for representatives. And the things that Washington does are supposed to be for America, number one, not for some other country. In fact, I have to tell you this. It occurred to me this morning as I was reading some things on a domestic issue that we have, with our, there's a lot of concern about illegal aliens and policies. Why doesn't, some people who are opposed to all of this immigration from the South, they say, well, George Bush is close with Fox, Vicente Fox down in Mexico, and that they make policies that are, he consults with Mexico before he makes a policy. And there are people in the anti-immigration movement who say, we put Mexican interests before American interests. So it's not, and no one gets in trouble when they say that. It's not a problem. This is free to, you can freely talk about that in this country. But when you say, is it possible that in this case or that case, in general or specifically, is it possible that we put in this country Israeli interests before our own? Then AIPAC kicks into action. Then that kind of speech is vilified. It becomes accusations of anti-Semitism are thrown out. We don't have that. The Mexicans need, in fact, maybe what we should do is tell the Mexicans, take a visit to Tel Aviv, find out how the Israelis did it and get their own Mexican lobby. And then no one can talk about how Mexico consults with George Bush and we do things that are good for Mexico rather than for America.
There's a funny sidebar to this because Stephen Jones got himself into a big mess by just saying that he saw evidence of international banker conspiracy behind 9/11. Now, that's what he said. Those are his exact words, an international banker conspiracy. Well, that was the Jewish lobby came out and said he was an anti-Semite for saying this. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they lambasted this man. Now,
the University of or his university out in Utah.
It's looking like that, which is really unbelievable because what happened to the sanctity of university research and understanding. I mean, this guy's a tenured professor. He didn't say anything ridiculous.
No, and he hasn't. To talk about international banking is not to say. Is not to say Jewish. It is not to say Zionist. It is not to say Israeli. It is to talk about international banking. It's the money industry. I don't think all the bankers in the world. I mean, this is a kind of
all the ones at the top are, Karen. All the ones at the top are, sadly.
No, but it's just like saying neoconservatives are just, they're not Jewish. We have more Christians are neoconservatives in this country, Christian Zionists, than others who see Israel as a
that's right
some biblical prophecy.
And this is one of the big fights we've been having, Karen, because I'm not against the Jews or the Christians or anybody. I'm against people, and you kind of pointed it out quite well. You said, how about America's interests? How about looking out for what's best for the American people? And darn well we're not doing that.
I'm saying I only know what one person sees. It seems in cases we're not, but people in this country need to pay attention to this because just like in Texas and New Mexico and Southern California, there may be a sense that Mexican government interests are holding sway over their interests as Americans, just like that. That's a legitimate concern. And if we look to Washington, D.C., and we look to our Middle East policy, we certainly ought to be able to ask that question. We ought to be able to say, is this good for the United States? And certainly this Lebanon disaster, terrible, terrible, terrible for the United States. It's a loss for Israel, and it's bad for them. But for the United States, it's even awful. We lost friends and allies. We got Christians over there getting supplied by American churches, And it's our own buddies that are causing them to be under duress, and there was no reason. There was no reason.
Well, but see, that's the interesting thing here. I don't see Israel as the American public's friend. It never has been, but it obviously is our government's friend. There's nothing about that nation, in my view, that's a friend to our country.
Well,
yet,
you know what though? There's a little subset of evangelical Christians, and they truly believe that Israel's government is somehow, you know, just, you know how people think George Bush is like God placed him there? There's a whole bunch of people that think that. Not that many actually, but
well, there's a bunch that are in the mental institutions across America, but I don't see any.
I'm telling you, people see Israel, if they see it in literal biblical, you know, a Christian literal interpretation of Revelation, you know, they see Israel as, no matter who their government is, Israel must be right. This, of course, is not good for this country. And one of the reasons we have separation of church and state here was, the founders had this idea that there's some certain things about religious desires that may not be compatible with a country.
Constitutional republic.
Absolutely. And
that's right, Karen.
And so, you know, we ought to pay attention to it.
Yep.
When we have Bush as a kind of evangelical-leaning, faith-based intelligence, faith-based president, and he has a small number of supporters that no matter what he does, they will say that it's good because they think God put him there. Many of those people do think that they don't look at Israel as a separate country. They look at Israel as a biblical location of, you know, prophecy.
It's a racist country, though, Karen. It doesn't give equal protection under the law for its own citizens.
You're talking about facts and evidence. The people who are faith-based foreign policy doesn't care for facts and evidence. And so
you're right. They don't care. Don't confuse me with the facts because I don't want to hear them.
That's right. And all I'm saying is there are people with blind belief, both Christian and actually a small percentage of Jews, actually, but more Christians in numbers.
You know, I feel that the biggest duped group in the world are the actual Israelis themselves. They have been threatened out of talking about this and lied to mm-hmm. into believing the nonsense. And they're probably the group in the world that's least capable of making rational decisions on their behalf of their own country.
Yeah.
Not very similar to the way the American public has been lied to. And I see them in many cases as victims of the propaganda just like we all have been. But I'm also seeing a sea change here. And I'm seeing for the first time conversation like ours, the one I just had before I got on the phone with you. I was talking to Ray. And then reading Kathleen Christensen's latest work, there is a leakage happening here of the truth. Truth is leaking out all over the place, and like the little Dutch boy and the dyke, they can't stop the flow. The flow of history is going to be heard in this instance, I believe, Karen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, certainly. And, you know, you talk about free speech. Here's another thing that I have to say I really admire in the state of Israel, that their newspapers actually debate all these issues that we're talking about and all the issues that Mearsheimer and Walt were talking about in their paper, that they were vilified here in this country by the AIPAC and other advocates, David Horowitz and people like that. And yet those kinds of things are freely debated, loudly and roundly debated, by all kinds of people in Israel, but their media in Israel is not afraid of tackling these topics, and then here in this country it seems like they are. So yeah, we have a little. There's some things here we need to straighten out. I have no doubt about it. You know,
I don't know going forward. I mean, because I see the veneer is getting scrubbed off of these people, and to call somebody an anti-Semite today doesn't have a sting it once had. In fact, they've cried this wolf story too many times, and you know, everybody's like, you're an anti-Semite, you're an anti-Semite, and when you start looking at it, Ashkenazis are not even Semitic. It's interesting, they come from the steppes of Russia,
so the
people that are actually, are saying, you're calling me an anti-Semite, I'm not Semitic. I mean, so it's the most ludicrous thing you've ever seen, and more and more people are actually seeing this as for what it is. My fear is this, that people, when they finally come to this, they may take a radical path and just stop blaming all Jews, and I think that would be a terrible mistake because all Jews are certainly not involved, Or the other side will happen where we lose our freedom altogether, and if we talk about it, we'll be jailed and called terrorists. I mean, they're already trying to make a domestic debate about these subjects an act of terrorism. These are the kinds of things being muttered around these new Homeland Security people. And, you know, for me talking about this, Karen, I've got hits on my website from Homeland Security. I mean, because I'm discussing these subjects, all of a sudden, what? They're going to try to say that I'm a terrorist? This is nonsense.
Yeah,
but to see, this is the Orwellian world we're living in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for Americans, we really have to pay close attention to the loss of our freedoms. You know, that's what I'm saying. When I say I admire the freedom of and the debate in the newspapers and on television in Israel, this is something we need to bring back here because we don't have it to that extent. We have a lot of just the same stuff from all the stations, and there's certain untouchable and undiscussable topics, and that has to change. It's true. Yeah, we have a big problem. This whole the response to 9/11 by the government, the growth, the massive growth, and you know, the Patriot Act, growth of Homeland Security industries, the whole idea that you know, everyone is a possible terrorist or has a terrorist under the bed. This is a big problem for our country, and I haven't studied it to say if there's any one group or anything else behind it. But the fact is, you know, human nature, when people are frightened, is to do what they're told in many cases. And the government, our government in Washington, has done a wonderful job of taking advantage of fear and promoting it. So we have a big
problem. What are we going to do, Karen, in the country when not only 50% of the population say that 9/11 was an inside job, but when it's up to 80%,
well,
and we know it was an inside job because...
I have to tell you this, and I hope Homeland Security folks are listening. Quite frankly, it was Thomas Jefferson that said, what is it, the Tree of Liberty is watered... the blood of
patriots.
Rebels, patriots, yeah. I think we will have a problem in this country that will have to be solved, and either in terms of some sort of collapse or multiple collapses,
mm-hmm.
or in terms of a major overthrow of the government. Now, when I say overthrow of the government, might that happen through elections? Well, you know, unlikely, but...
yeah, especially with the two-party system. We know, you know, Karen, I got to tell everybody, I've been it's going on 19 years as a libertarian, and I know you're also a libertarian, but we don't get squat when it comes to elections, do we?
No, it's true, but you know, just think of the possibility of some shifts in Washington, just if the House goes Democratic, which it will go Democratic, and when it does, while they will not, as you know this, they will not look in particularly to, they will not look hard at Israel's influence, and they will not look hard at the Israeli lobby, certainly. But George Bush is in big trouble if the House launches investigations into impeachable offenses, or even if they don't even look at impeachable offenses, they just launch into things like, did the president violate Geneva? I mean, these are terrible things that will tie this president's hands. They're good for the country, bad for Bush. And it's going to happen. That will happen regardless, as soon as the House switches over.
Well, unless they cheat on the elections like they've been doing. I mean, they've got these electronic machines that cheat like crazy.
Well, that's true, and so we have that concern. And again, if we can't do it peaceably, we'll do it non-peaceably.
There you go. You know, and I'm a guy that's never advocated any violence. But I'll tell you something right now. I worry that if the economy goes south like it may, because they've been printing all this money, Karen.
Uh-huh.
And then they do something senseless like institute a draft, and the young people get angry, and George Bush starts getting put to the rack here for all the crimes he's committed. Boy, we just might see some terrible stuff, and it might just get out of hand.
Well, let me tell you this one thing. Happy note. We're probably running out of time here, but
yep.
My daughter went out to a local city festival of some kind they had this weekend on Saturday,
mm-hmm.
and she was there yesterday, and she said. Her and her boyfriend saw this guy, and he had a T-shirt on. It said, I can't say what it is on radio. It said F. Bush on one side.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the back side of the shirt, it said something like, bring troops home or something. And I said, so, that's okay, that's fine. We are a heavily Republican county, but, you know, okay, fine. Young guy has this. And she goes, no, but he just got out of the Army. She was gone to school with her boyfriend, and he had just gotten out of the Army, and he's wearing an F. Bush basically bring the troops home. I oppose this president, at least.
Well, when he's in the ICU unit for dying from depleted uranium poisoning in about a year and a half, he's really going to feel like F. Bush, isn't he?
I'll tell you what, this is the thing. And so what goes around comes around, and I don't really, it's not my issue. I want to put America's interests first, and I don't want to see our country influenced by another country. I don't care if it's Mexico or Israel or any other country.
I agree with you.
Great Britain. You know, I don't care. I want our interests to be put first, and then I want the government to do wise and prudent things, and certainly our foreign policy in the Middle East is neither wise nor prudent.
Well, you know that my show, I'm kind of the tip of the spear out there, Karen, and I have never shrunk from any of these debates and stuff, but I'm an honest broker for these facts. I'm not looking for people's heads. I'm not looking for criminality everywhere. What I'm trying to do here is build a base for debate and a base for honest appraisal of where we are. And, you know, I think I've done a decent job of it, but of course, when you're over the target, boy, the flak gets really heavy. I had to know going into this that this was going to get like this on us, and Eric and I, we, and Christopher Bolin and others, We've been over that target for a while, and of course, I don't think it's going to abate. I think it's probably going to get tougher for us. But what's the alternative? I can't look and watch this and do nothing. I just can't. I know you feel the same way, and I know your family has a long history of not turning a blind eye to these facts. So, for a parting thing, what would you like to leave my listeners with?
Oh, I don't know. I think in the midst of all the things that we see, we have to hold to what's true. And that could be what's true in our own lives. It could be what's true, philosophically. But we hold to that. And I think, there's some positive things that we can see. There's even positive things if we have an economic collapse. That will be positive because it will break the financial back of our government. And,
yep.
In this country, I'm speaking, in America, it will break, and that's a good thing. I hate to say this, I never thought I would, as half of my time in the military was under the Cold War, but China, is a big, purchaser of our debt, which allows us to continue with whatever it is that our government does.
Yeah.
Both domestically and in foreign policy.
That's so right.
We don't make this money. We borrow it.
Mm-hmm.
So my children and my grandchildren will pay it off, we think, unless it's written off. And, so, I wouldn't mind, quite frankly, if my government did go broke, more broke than it already is, and had to listen to what the Chinese wanted us to do. Because, quite frankly, right now, the Chinese have a wiser foreign policy, than we do. And they know their advice would be very good. So I guess what I'm saying is there are always silver linings in these clouds.
Well, I don't think we're, off into the future here. I don't see the American government floating itself much longer. I mean, mm-hmm. Here's the thing. The Chinese in the last treasury auction didn't buy the debt, and the debt remained unsold. And guess what? The government bought its own debt. And I thought that was illegal. And they bought $4 billion in an auction of their own debt. Now, how can the government buy your own debt?
That sounds very wrong. Wow.
Well, they did that.
Well, and that's a sign. If it happened like that, and I can't imagine it's not illegal. But if they got away with it, that's certainly a sign of desperation. And that desperation is a happy point. It should be a happy point for us if we can get through its final death throes.
Well, there'll be a lot of suffering associated with those facts, sadly, and I urge people, and I know you do too, Karen,
yeah.
To become more self-sufficient. I know you have your own little garden over there. We don't call it a victory garden in this generation, but it's
kind of like that, yeah.
Well, it is, and I mean, I just harvested and put my stuff in conserve, in bell jars, and I mean, hey, if you don't start taking care of yourself, I don't see the government going to be there, and I don't see your neighbors going to be helping you out either. I think
absolutely
people have to look to themselves here.
They absolutely do, and in all the worries that we have about the big picture things, that we never want to forget to take care of those personal relationships, because when the crap hits the fan, that's what's going to matter, and that's what'll get us through this. I mean, we have these big picture concerns, these things we've been talking about, the kind of very awful, awful things. But also never forget to, nurture yourself, take care of your, be as self-sufficient as you can, and be able to help your neighbors and your relatives, because those are the ones that will come through for you in a time of need, not the government. And, of course, anybody that's ever studied any government, they never come through for the people in time of need. The governments are nothing but consumers and parasites. So,
well, you know, Karen, you and I go back a while now. I mean, I was probably one of the first people to interview you back years ago now. It's starting to be anyway. And I'll tell you, I get worn out by this. I'm sure you do. I just want to let you know that you have a wonderful family. I've had the opportunity to speak to them in brief periods, and I'm proud of my family, and I know you're proud of yours. And I'd like to have pride in my country again, and I'd like to be proud of the things that we do, mm-hmm. not in a sense of being a warlike people, but rather a compassionate and caring people. Mm-hmm. And we've got some real soul searching to do before any of those things happen. And I'm just urging people to really dig deep and start making some real decisions about what they want for the life of the country and themselves.
Yeah, that's real important. We have to take responsibility. One of the reasons that our government is doing the things that it's done in the past, really in the past century, but most particularly recently, is because we have not been paying attention to it. And
it has
its own lifestyle, which it's very happy with, but we have to take responsibility. You know, we say, well, we didn't do it. Why does everybody hate us? We didn't do it. It was the people in Washington. But you know what? They say, you're a democracy. You own that government in Washington, and it reflects you. And if it doesn't reflect us, we need to make the changes so that it does reflect us. And that means, we talk about electronic voting. Well, how can you do that? Well, look back to the founders. You know, they weren't afraid of a little civic action.
A little Donnybrook in the streets or something.
Well, you know what? They absolutely weren't. And it may be that that's what'll be called for. But, I try to stay optimistic about this stuff.
Well, I want to thank you for spending this time, and go. I know you've been over the same facts often, but they're important, and they're important for the new listeners as well as for the people who did know them to be refreshed a little bit about some things that went on in the Pentagon. Mm-hmm. And I want to thank you for just keeping the fight alive here and keeping everybody. Karen, if everybody just gets afraid to start speaking out, I don't think we're going to have much of a chance, and we could end up like the Soviet system did in 1917, and I certainly am not going to let that happen if I have any say in the matter.
Yeah,
but it's been great to know you, and it's wonderful to talk to you again. And I'll tell you what, in about a month or two, or maybe 2.5 months, if new events have taken place, so maybe we'll get in touch with you again, and we can speak again for a short time.
Sure, I'd love to. That'd be fine.
Thanks, Karen.
Okay, well, thank you. It's good talking to you.
All right, bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, Karen Kotowski, Lieutenant Colonel, friend, family person, writer, author, teacher, doctor, PhD, just a wonderful patriot, somebody who has a great take on things. And, you know, you have to understand, too, that she works very hard for, in her career life, but she finds the time, as many of you do out there, to keep fighting for the truth. You know, this is somebody who's working, I think, even two jobs, if I remember correctly, and yet she still finds the time to write articles and to speak on radio and to do all of the things that civic things that are required of us at this point in our history. So I'm inspired by the effort she makes. She doesn't stay on top of some of our issues as well as some others because, you know, frankly, not everybody's fighting exactly the same fight as we are. But world Zionism is the problem that we face, and it manifests itself all over our government and all over our world, ladies and gentlemen. And the battle rages on. And I hope that you all can inform others about what we've said today, and get people to listen to the French Connection, because this is the place where the honesty is being shared. So until the next time, this is Darryl Bradford Smith saying. Bye-bye now. Be well.